I've really kind of enjoyed this opportunity to take 5 days to present this material. Never done that before. And so I've been getting these slides up as I go. And I know that you all have, a lot of people have been talking about they'd like to have the slides. This is kind of a work in process. I've just been doing this at the motel every morning. So I'm going to work on them some, because I like to be reasonably sure they actually say what I mean. I will at some point try to get them, making them available if you would like to have some. All right, now this morning we come to these final phases, and if you're here and this is the first time or you've missed some of this stuff, you are kind of jumping into the middle of this, and it might be a little hard to pick up on where we are. And certainly there's a lot that's gone before that I think gives substance to and a surrounding for what I want to talk about today, which is our present situation. So if you haven't been here, you've just missed a lot. Now, like I tell my students, I don't have a compulsory attendance policy in my classes, and they don't have to come, but I do take roll, and I always tell them, I won't punish you, I just want something so when your mama calls and wants to know why you failed, I can tell her. So that's where we are. Now, the other thing I'd like to do is maybe I'm just going to try to breeze through this more quickly, although it's really hard for me to do that. But I'd like to leave some time for questions. Several people have privately asked me questions about things that actually would be good for us to get on the floor. So I'll try to leave myself maybe 10 minutes or so at the end, and you can think of if you could possibly have any questions at the end. Now, what we come to then is, in this five-way periodization of what's happened to the people who in the early 19th century set out to just restore New Testament Christianity, you have these periods of flourishing when the churches grow in the midst of considerable dissonance and disagreement and debate, but nonetheless grow, and then these general sorting outs, which are characterizations of two different kinds of divisions that take place in the Restoration Movement. And that is, we have divisions among like-minded people that happen all the time. Sometimes they're bad. These made some good comments about what the limitations of our debating and dividing ought to be. Perfectly proper for us to discuss questions. Sometimes congregations divide, brethren get alienated from one another, who disagree. But I believe that's inevitable. It's inevitable in an open environment of discussion about what God's Word says. But those are kind of certain kinds of divisions that take place among like-minded people. Then what we have is these sorting outs in which people come to distrust one another's motives and think, well, we're not really trying to do the same thing anymore. And so that happens from 1865 to 1900, 1950 or so, and then the Churches of Christ separate and more or less go their own way and are isolated from their former brethren. But they grow again. And then, beginning in the period after World War II, there's another sorting out that takes place that most of us in this audience are quite familiar with. That is that there are churches all over this area with Church of Christ on the front of them and all over this country that believe quite different things and practice quite different things and are pretty well alienated and isolated and separated from one another. Now, it's not this clear-cut. It's not just three groups. But generally speaking, there are kind of three informal areas or groups of association that have taken place. So we talked about that a little bit already. And that's the comment that I made yesterday about the nature of these divisions. It's always fluid. people move back and forth. Lots of people don't clearly identify in one direction or the other. I just added one thing to that chart this morning. The choice we make is we have to choose where we're going to live our life. I mean, I didn't do this. I didn't cause it. Nobody else causes it. It happens over the course of time as people spread out and change. And what I do and what everybody else has to do is they have to choose where they're going to live their life. And that's really the only choice you make. You don't decide who's in the Church of Christ. God decides. God's the one that adds people to the Lord's church. You don't decide what Churches of Christ ought to teach. Every local congregation decides what it stands for. The decision you make is you make a decision with whom am I going to work and worship. And that's all. Now, I know a lot of you are familiar with Lagarde's book on fellowship. I think the fundamental mistake in that book is that it tries to establish in tenuous ways other kinds of lines of fellowship that we have. But I don't think you do. You just have fellowship with people with whom you are comfortable doctrinally, who you believe teach the truth and have the correct attitude towards the truth, and you worship and work with a congregation. And those are the only decisions, essentially, that you make. Now, let me quickly just talk about these divisions. The institutional division over institutional issues takes place from 1945 really to about 1965. And a group of churches are essentially separated in their lines of communication, lines of fellowship, by 1965. We have generally said that there are three areas of doctrinal debate that took place. One that had to do with church support of institutions. None of these issues were new in 1945. All of these things had gone on for a long time. And in fact, most people had actually practiced all of them. It's not true of church support for institutions, because there had always been people who thought that was not proper. Churches did send money to colleges before World War II, and it was discussed. And there was not really a division about it, although people were quite concerned about it. There were only a few colleges, and there were only a few orphan homes. There were seven orphan homes, I think, by 1945, and just a few colleges. So it's not a big issue. It becomes a big issue after World War II, because the number of colleges increased dramatically, the number of other institutions increased dramatically, and there was, immediately after World War II, a major effort by colleges to get churches to support colleges. So many people thought that was a serious departure. I believe, by the way, it is a departure that... If you were here Wednesday night, this violates my chart that I put up on what a Church of Christ was, and that is I just don't find Churches of Christ doing that in the New Testament, and consequently I'm not going to do it if they didn't do it. I think institutionalism is not, well, in fact I know it is, just academically, it's not a good way to do things anyhow. I had a guy send me, since my book has come out, a guy sent me a set of articles not long ago which were really intriguing. For instance, this article is entitled, "Who's Doing the Work of the Church? Organizations that purport to assist the local church have taken on functions that properly belong to the church." And this is a really good article on institutionalism and how institutions have come to overtake these churches and live off them and do things that they ought not to be doing. This is an interesting article. It's out of the Gospel Advocate. Which was one of the primary defenders of institutionalism. He sent me a whole packet of articles out of the Advocate, basically because I'd said a nice thing about the Advocate in my book. Another one says the Trojan horse. He says, "As an institution, the Lord's Church is assailed on many fronts. The challenges are from the world, sometimes are easier to face than the challenges from within our ranks. Let the church be just the church. I believe I said that at some point in the past. One challenge comes from congregations attempting to be something other than that which God has called them to be. The work of the church is not entertainment, nor is it social enhancement. The legitimate work of the church consists of edification, evangelism, and benevolence. Well, I could have written that article back in the 50s. In fact, I think I did. There's another one by Everett Hufford, who's at Harding, on the work of the church. That is, let me just say that these issues were debated amidst heat, in which people said things they shouldn't say on both sides. But they were efforts to honestly look at them scripturally. Are these things that belong in our concept of New Testament churches doing what they did in New Testament days? But in hindsight, there are a lot of people that are looking back and saying, you know, that was not a good way to go. Now, I have to tell you, I don't think those people will come back. That is, most of them won't come back. But there is a kind of a realization that there was lots about that was counterproductive. Well, the three issues were essentially whether churches ought to send money to institutions. I don't believe New Testament churches did that. Consequently, they don't think we ought to do it. Second issue was the sponsoring church. Now, sponsoring church, if you read my book, a lot of you have already read my book, which is wonderful. If you read my book, you'll see how sponsoring church in many ways was, I think, the most critical issue after World War II. Because I will tell you what people came out of World War II on a high. The churches had grown rapidly. The whole world seemed to be open to evangelism. Churches had money. And they had this sense of that we are somebody and we're going to make our place felt in the world. It came out of it with what comes to be what's known as the on-the-march mentality. You know, and I called it kind of a boosterism, that we wanted to be big. And the sponsoring church lent itself to that. Sponsoring church just means that one church, other churches sent to one church to sponsor a work and take control of it. And actually, that had been done for a long time in kind of small ways. And people hadn't thought it through or thought about it. But after World War II, it was done in very big ways. And lots of people began to back off of it and say, that's really not a scriptural pattern. That's not the way work was done. And I will tell you, that doesn't work. If you want to see that not working, you can go to India with me sometime, and I'll show you that not working. Because it's hierarchical and denominational from the beginning. And it creates, and that's a society that loves that sort of thing. Well, the other thing is social gospel issues. And that article that I just read spoke to that. And that is whether the church in New Testament days had essentially a responsibility for providing for people's recreational and social needs. Now, I could talk with you a long time historically about the emergence of the social gospel movement. That's something that's been coming for 150 years among all religious groups. If you go back about 150 years, virtually no church, assumed that it had social responsibility. You can actually trace that in church architecture. You go back and find a church building built more than 150 years ago, I'll tell you what it'll be. It'll be an auditorium. That's all, because that's what they imagine that the church ought to be doing, is evangelizing and preaching the gospel. It's not until you get to about the middle of the 19th century that people began to add other stuff to their auditorium, because they developed this kind of social mission to the church. Well, those were the doctrinal issues. So, lots of times, if you were going to define what was the division about, and what we'd do is go and say they were about these issues. Actually, I don't really think that's what they were about. Now, I believe what they were about was about changing attitudes. The truth is, we had all of those issues for a long time. But the time came when people came to have different approaches to how we ought to establish what the church ought to be. And I don't have time to do this this morning, but let's just say that I believe what the non-institutional attitude represented was the old traditional restoration attitude, that what we want to do is just go back and read the New Testament and do exactly what we find in the New Testament. That another attitude that emerged was that what we need to do is we need to build the Church of Christ. into something that's big. And in that sense, what developed was a kind of denominational pride. Or, as the New Progressives called it, that's the New Progressive critique of the churches in the 1950s, that what they were is they were the cultural church, that they had become a church that was acclimated to society and wanted to build its image. And if you're trying to do different things, then you will go away building different churches. Well, why don't you skip that? I talked about that last night. Richard Hughes, in his book, has tried to trace the kind of central motif in the thinking of the Restoration Movement, and he calls it apocalyptic, or the sojourner mentality. I call it alienation and separation. What non-institutional people represented, for the most part, were people who still felt alienated from the world and separated. There develops a different attitude toward what the church ought to be. And that's what we've just been talking about. I have the technical sociological term down there for, I think, what emerges in the 1950s, and that is an established sect. But I don't have time to tell you what that means. And so, well, let's pass over that. All right, let me talk about a few of the leaders. Well, here are some of the leaders. Don't have any pictures, but you'd recognize some of these people. I don't know. The DB down there. But you would recognize some of those. Here's some of the mainstream leaders. I'm going to get pictures to plug into all of this. And among the progressives, well, there's some interesting stories there, but once again, we don't have time to talk about it. So I'm going to stop in just a minute and let you ask the question. That's kind of the non-institutional division. Non-institutional people are separated largely on those attitudinal and sociological issues. They're separated, as well as the doctrinal issues. There's a second division that has taken place, 1980s and in the 1990s, between progressives and mainstream. It has to do essentially with two issues. One, the new hermeneutic. That is, there are many people in so-called mainstream churches of Christ who actually remain quite conservative in their view of the Scriptures. I have problems with the people in this middle group, because I find them to be very traditional. That is, they are wedded to the Church of Christ. They are wedded to what the group was in 1950. And I find them to be very difficult to reason with scripturally, because it seems to me they are set to defend not just what they read in the Scriptures, but they are set to defend what they are. And what, consequently, what the progressive group call them is, they call them the cultural church, that there are a church that is dominated by this kind of cultural perception of themselves. They became quite conservative politically and in other ways. And so these progressives criticize them. It's interesting to me. In some ways, if you separate these groups of people, I obviously, theologically, I'm a lot closer to people in the middle. That is, we believe a lot more things in common. Temperamentally, I'm actually closer to the people on the other extreme. Because what the people on the other extreme say is, they say, look, you in the middle, you're doing things that our plea does not authorize. And you no longer follow the hermeneutic. And so what you are is, you are a cultural church. And I called them a cultural church 25 years before the progressives called a cultural church. You know, I wrote a tract called The Emergence of the Church of Christ Denomination back in 1962, in which I said that this is where this was going. So I find those people quite difficult to reason with, whereas there's kind of an honesty on the other end, in which people say, well, we're not really living up to our plea. And so lots of times, you know, I'll go to conferences and those guys will say, well, I said, you know, really, I believe the same thing you believe about the church and what's happening. I said, well, no, you don't believe the same thing I believe, or you wouldn't be where you are. Now, but what they do is they're good at identifying the problem. I don't think they're good at identifying the solution. Because the solution that they have is a hermeneutical solution which says, well, our plea won't work. You can't restore New Testament Christianity if what you're talking about is propositionally going back and saying you ought to do these things. Consequently, what they will do is say, we don't do it. Consequently, we don't have to do it. And what we're free to do is structure a church however our ethical principles and biblical interpretation takes us, and where it's taking them, obviously. And they accuse these people in the middle of being very captured by their culture, by the way. Nobody's more captured by their culture than the progressives are. Their culture, it's a different culture. It's the culture of University of Chicago and Harvard professors. And what they are going to do is they want to be sure that they're on the same page with their professors about women's rights and everything else. And so what they do is create a classically liberal denomination. All right, now that's where they are. There's their attitudes. Okay. That's where we are, folks, by the way. I don't like it. Don't recommend it. I wish it wasn't that way. Sometimes somebody will say, well, wouldn't it be good if we were all together? Wouldn't it be good if all the way back to 1800 we were all together? Then we'd have 5 million people. The only problem with that is we're not all together. We're quite different. And when you become different, there's just natural forces that just press you apart. And so that's what happens. And what all of us have to do is we have to decide where we are and where we ought to live our lives. Well, you know, I just need to end here by saying a word or two about non-institutional Church of Christ. Non-institutional churches of Christ, and I hope somebody will come up with a better thing to way to label that, have since the 1960s lived a separate life. Do you know it's interesting? I'll tell you how that works, how that dividing works. I will always feel myself having a certain kinship with people scattered all across this movement, because actually I started on the other side. And I know people all over this spectrum. David Lipscomb, by the way, always thought of himself as being part of the whole early Restoration movement. He always thought of the disciples as being his erring brethren and so on. I never have really thought of people in Christian churches in that way. Actually, Alexander Campbell and Barton Stone always thought of the denominationalists. They thought of Presbyterians and Baptists as their erring brethren, because that was the group they left. And tried to teach. With my children, that's really quite different. They would feel quite strange being in some other congregation. So we've come to have a kind of an existence of our own. And we will begin to have a history of our own now. And I'll tell you what's happening is if we've gone through a kind of period of consolidation and rebuilding. You know, most people my age, we went through a period of just starting congregations. I started a lot of congregations. I have no idea. Most every place I'd go, I'd have to start something. And a lot of preachers got fired. A lot of people had to start making a living, an honest living, you know. And there were good things about that period. There were bad things about it. What everybody, kind of the congregational aim was to get where you could support a full-time man, you know, and then afford to build a building. And that was, for a long time, for a whole generation, that was almost the aim of the church. That's what we're trying to do. So people, we were just trying to rebuild. And that's happened. And actually, since the 1970s, and particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, we have been in a very period of rapid growth. And now, we don't have good statistics about this, but non-institutional churches are growing very fast. And I say that, you know, this is always different in different areas and different places, but it's true in most places. I mean, I can remember when Atlanta, Georgia, there was one place I could go preach in Atlanta, and it had about 50 members. There are probably now 20 churches in Atlanta, quite a few of them. Several of them have 300-400 members. And so there's just been a tremendous expansion that manifests itself in lots of different ways, by the way. Among other things, you know, people are going to so many different places in the world now. We're going to China and Philippines and India and East Europe and every place in the world. We couldn't have done that 30, 35 years ago. We were trying to get enough money to pay for somebody to preach where we were. That's a product of this explosive kind of growth. And you know why we're growing? I'll tell you why we're growing. We're growing because we had some really good on-the-march programs to grow. No, that is not right. Actually, that did not work. You know, mainstream churches went through a period in the 1970s when they actually shrank. I think that they probably are stable at this point, they may still be shrinking. And they've got this subsequent second division to go through. We grew because we got all the good preachers. Actually, we didn't get any of the big preachers for the most part. I'll tell you why non-institutional churches have grown. It is because really they've been people of conviction. There are people who are deeply convicted that you ought to be New Testament Christians and that you ought to follow the Scriptures. They were the most committed people. Now, we've also had a lot of problems. I have said many years, I said it back in the 1960s, when this division came, that what happened is most of the people who didn't really care, who didn't have much conviction, went in institutional directions. People who had deep convictions became non-institutional, but non-institutional people also, we got most of the nuts. But that's always true of conservative movement, and so we go through this period once again in which there's lots of debate and discussion, struggle, but it is taking place in the midst of growth, and I believe we're growing because people have commitment. We're also growing for the same reason Churches of Christ grew at the beginning of the 20th century, and that is lots of people are moving out of more liberal environments into conservative environments, and they like it. You know, we're in a period now when neither one of these groups knows much about each other. The young people in here don't know anything about institutional churches. And young people in institutional churches don't know anything about non-institutional churches. And so there's really not much prejudice there. Lots of people just come in to your communion, and they like it. I was preaching down in Lakeland, Florida, sometime back, and standing back at the back with Brent after the service, and an older couple walked by, and the lady said to the man, she said, "I told you if we kept visiting around, we'd find some place where they studied the Bible." So, I mean, there are a lot of folks that if you just study the Bible, they come in, they'll like that. They've kind of been looking for that. So there's a gravitation in that direction. I tell you, there's some wonderful churches now. I'm thankful for all of it. Get to go visit them. Thankful for you all. But I want to tell you something. You're not the same kind of people that I used to preach to 30, 40 years ago. Now, in some ways, people are better. I mean, we got better classes. We got better teachers. Young people are trained better. Auburn, we're just full of wonderful young people. But you guys have got more money than the people I used to preach to. And you're better educated than the people I used to preach to. I tell you, you're more connected to the world than most of the people I used to teach to. You're more part of the culture than most of the people I used to preach to. So, I will tell you what we have all over the country. We've got a lot of congregations. I rarely go to a congregation that I have much concern about, because I tell you who the elders are. Elders are people like me. Elders are people from another generation. But in another 10, 15 years, I'll tell you what you're going to have. You're going to have another generation of elders. Now, nothing's inevitable in history. Deed has made that point quite forcefully lots of occasions. Whenever I get to the end of this, it always just sounds like, well, you know, that's the way it's going to happen. Nothing's just going to happen the way it's going to happen. And I can't tell you what you ought to do about it. I've preached this, my sociological principles, one time, and a guy came up to me and said, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that we ought to try to keep our children ignorant and poor? And I said, well, I did a pretty good job of that. But no, either they're going to be what they're going to be. And you know, I know educated people who are wonderful Christians. I mean, I hope I can make it to heaven. I know rich people who are wonderful Christians. We just need to live our lives with a kind of a historical consciousness. And I will tell you, that is where you're at. And that is what the next generation faces, is good churches, big churches, full of different kind of people who sure need to know where they're going and what it means to be a denominational Christian. Didn't leave you any time for questions. So I'm sure I answered all your questions. Anybody? One pressing question. All right, Trent.
When you refer to refuge.
Yes, I think so. I mean, that's a good question. It's a kind of complicated question, and I do deal with it in the book. And that is that there are kind of two stages of the people who would call themselves progressive, who are, by the way, the majority and dominant group in mainstream churches of Christ. And the first stage was people who had, I think, questioning, non-traditional views of what ought to be done, but people who were quite rooted in the tradition. There is today, I think, it's there since the 1980s, people like Tom Allwright at Abilene and Richard and others would argue that there is now a new generation who are genuinely, I think, liberal, theological liberals and modernists who are thoroughly committed to postmodernism and deconstruction and other ideas. So that the leadership of the progressive movement today, I think, is falling into the hands of people who would genuinely deserve the label liberal. Though earlier people, like maybe Leroy Garrett and Ketcherside, I think, had a different, slightly different cast. Okay, well, actually my time is up, you guys. So I better quit in deference to the other speakers. Thanks.